You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, March 22nd, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Wait, what do I say? Hey, everybody. Hello. Crap.
What's really? Up?
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
I can't top Bob, but hello, everyone.
Your second worst intro ever.
Oh, my God. That is saying something.
Ouch.
That's what I was shooting for. That's
second worst.
Good. Well, you were mission accomplished. Was it just last week we were talking about the fact that just out of nowhere, the Senate unanimously passed this bill with a provision to make daylight savings time permanent, perennial, basically year-round. And we all thought that was a great idea. And we got, this was our most email response topic of the week, you know, just
definitely
offhand discussion that we were having. Everybody had basically the same feedback. Like, we were saying how, you know, this was a great idea, but actually it's controversial, or it could be a bad idea, and there are concerns about going to perennial daylight savings time. But here's the thing. We were only, there's two components to this, right? One is making one time permanent, and then the other
is it
DST versus, you know, daylight savings time versus standard time. And we were only really talking about the first bit. It's like, yes, it's, and that is really not controversial. Everyone pretty much agrees, scientists, et cetera, no matter what angle you look at it, the feedback is basically everyone agrees we should have one perennial time, that and that most of the negative impacts come from the switching twice a year. Like, there's definitely an increase in car accidents after the spring forward and more heart attacks and things like that. So let's talk about the second part, right? Since we didn't talk about that last week, daylight savings time versus standard time. What do you guys think?
So if we stay on daylight saving, that means then that the sun is up later. Well, okay. The day is shorter regardless in the winter, right? The sun is out for less time in the winter regardless.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if we stay on daylight saving, we're pushing the sun back slightly later. So there's a chance that people are going to work and school in the dark. And that seems to be the biggest complaint, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if we do it the opposite way, our day starts with more sun, but it gets dark earlier in the day.
Right.
I guess the question is, which is more depressing, and also which is – honestly, like from a public health perspective, which is healthier? I think early morning sun is probably healthier.
Well, the changing of time, I've read many, many, many times, because I think this article comes out every year, that when the time changes, like, people die because of it.
Well, yeah, but we're saying, all things being equal, there is no time shift. Which one do we stick
with? Right, which one do we lock in? The one where you get less sun in the morning or more sun in the evening? Or no.
Those are the same thing, Evan.
Yes, the same thing. more sun in the morning, more sun in the evening.
Evan solved the problem. No, but
yes,
I think we do the one that requires no change.
No, but either of them require a change. Either we default to daylight saving or we default to standard time.
You have to choose
one. We're going to change once.
Standard time all the way, 100%.
Okay,
guaranteed,
so if we stick with...
No risk, guaranteed.
So if we stick with standard time, you're saying what a lot of the emailers said and what I just said about it's lighter earlier in the day.
Yeah, gets dark.
The sun's going to set at like 4 o'clock
I don't like that.
In some parts of the country.
I like more light in the evening because...
Me too.
Because if more... I imagine the majority of people work sort of the classic 9-to-5 kind of work day. That extra hour in the evening of light allows you to do more activities in the evening, whereas you're not going to be doing those activities anyways in the morning. You're kind of squandering that morning light.
Well,
yeah, but from a purely circadian kind of health neurological perspective, waking up with the sun is healthier. It is. Like, shift workers don't do as well.
Wait,
well, that's shift working, though. But hang on. So now I'm going to give you the actual answer.
Oh, come on.
Okay, wait, I didn't realize this was
and the answer is, my favorite answer to these questions is complicated. but as I did do a deep dive on this. I just want to say, what does the science say? Because right after this happened, like, the American Sleep Association said, no, this is bad. It should be daily. It should be standard time. Because so there's this concept of social jet lag, right? Which is a disconnect between your work hours, like when you get up and go to bed, and the sunrise and sunset. And they said that that standard time is better aligned with our circadian rhythm than daylight saving time.
Wait, so which one is standard then? Just make
standard
that clear.
Is earlier sun.
Standard time
more
is
sun in the morning.
Yeah. So we just like in the winter, that winter is standard time, the summer is daylight saving time.
For us in the northern hemisphere.
Doesn't matter what hemisphere you're in. Because I said seasons, not months.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. But in any case, if we did take just the purely scientific view rather than the personal choice view, that's what I'm saying. The scientific
view. That's what I was making an argument for.
I agree with you that I agree that that's the standard, the answer that, but I looked into that and that's actually a really shaky conclusion. So there was a systematic review that was published a couple years ago. Think of this question keeps coming up. And they said, you know, the data is really not there, and scientists should be a little bit more soft on their recommendations. That, first of all, we don't really have any head-to-head DST versus standard time scientific studies. We just don't.
But we must have studies of people who work an earlier shift versus people who – like people who drive to work in the dark versus people who drive to work in the light.
So, what I'm reading is we don't really have any head-to-head studies. Hmm. So, everything is inferred mainly from the time shifting, and that's not really a good control, you know, because
not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the real answer is we don't know. But having said that, you know, if you take the evidence that we do have, what you could say is, all right, even though it's secondary sort of inferential evidence, it is leaning towards that standard time is better than daylight saving time, but the effect size is not that big. And so that's the other thing. It's like, okay, sure, but does it really matter?
It doesn't matter either way.
What about all the people who wrote in to say, we tried that?
Well,
we tried that for 2 years to shift to daylight saving and everybody freaked out and hated it and we shifted back.
Yeah, so there's other variables though too. So one of the points that a lot of the people brought up is, well, it's not as safe for children to go to school in the morning. But we've talked previously about the fact that school starts too early anyway. So in the same organization, the same Sleep Association of America, whatever, says, so you should start school an hour later. No, if you did start school an hour later, that would completely offset the permanent daylight saving time. So,
but that's an example, Steve, of where like we're making decisions based on that sort of social thing, not based on the health. Like the reason kids go to school when they go to school is because it's convenient for the parents because of their jobs.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is what I think after reading all this. I don't think it really matters is the bottom line. I think what does matter is going to one time. That's what matters. Mm-hmm. The shift is bad. Shifting twice a year is definitely a no-go.
Well, why don't you want more daylight at the end of the day?
Well, here's the thing.
Bob and I are in the same camp.
This is why. Let me get to my actual point. If the clocks don't change, then the only other variable is when do you start school? When do you start work? It's the social clock, right? And so that we can leave up to the individual. And to the individual school system or, you know, or company or whatever, because everyone is enforced to change because of the clocks are changing. You can decide, or the school system could decide, well, given that this is the time and everything else, we're going to have school start at this time to make sure that it's, you know, the kids get enough sleep and it's light out in the morning when they're going to school, whatever. And it's fixed because the clock is fixed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but do you really think that would happen, Steve?
Well, I think
people are just going to keep doing things. Yeah, but I think people are going to do things the way they always did it because they think that's what they should do.
But that's social convention. We can't change the sun, but we can. We have 100% control over when we decide that school is going to start or work is going to start or whatever. And companies,
that would take such a momentous cultural shift to go from now on. We're just going to like go to work at 10 instead of 8. Like, I just don't think it's going to happen.
Well, I disagree with that. First of all, a lot of companies have already moved to flex time where people can go in, you know, they can decide what, you know, 8 hour period they want to work during the day. They can come an hour early. They can come an hour late. You know, and that helps too, because then that spreads out rush hour. So we're not all trying to get to work at the same exact time.
But certain industries don't allow for it. Like, it is an understood and known fact that like out here in LA in the entertainment industry, our days start between like 9 and 10. In New York, in the financial services industries, the days start at like 7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again,
there's whole industries that have convention. But also Wall Street is Wall Street. Like If you got to be at work when the market opens, you got to be at work when the market opens.
Yeah, but can't the market just decide we're going to open at 8 instead of 7?
They can, but they won't, is what I'm saying.
But if we're
there's being idealistic and then there's being practical.
But if we're changing the time, right? We're changing the clocks. That's a bigger change, you know. Then
I have a solution.
Yeah,
I have a solution. Steve.
Daylight, leave it alone.
We're gonna do what they do in some parts of India, and I think there's a couple other places on the planet that do it, and it's batshit. We'll split the difference,
half hour,
and we'll make time on the half hour.
Oh, that's stupid.
there are literally some regions that do that. Isn't that bananas?
There are some.
Their time zone is on the half hour.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, look at the time zone map. There's some weird places.
Well, that's the other thing to think about this, though, is that we have one-hour time zones. So that means that there are people who are already an hour shifted compared to other people in the same time zone.
Absolutely.
So the whole, that's my point. It doesn't really matter. And you got to individualize anyway. If you're on the western edge of a time zone, you may decide that you're going to do things an hour early on the clock or whatever. That's why I think the only real important thing is that we don't change twice a year. We just pick one.
Lock
that's the time. And then now everyone can decide, when they're going to do stuff. And not everybody is forced to shift their clock, twice a year.
All right. So I'm going to jump in and make an argument for me and Evan. All right. Another.
Thank you, Bob.
First off, I mean, I want summertime in that I want the day to be as long as possible in terms of sunlight at the end of the day. All right. To me, that's just like, why doesn't everybody feel that way? Secondly.
Yeah, but summer's already long, even if you're on daylight.
I know. I know. that extra hour at the end of the day, I love. Secondly, I mean, people complain about, driving to work in the dark. First off, the sunrise is a beautiful thing. How many do you see? How many sunrises are you going to see until the end of your life? You could probably not that many because most people wake up when it's already up. This way, you drive to work, you see a sunrise 5 days a week. That's awesome.
That's a good argument, Bob. This is like, we're doing the throwdown right now and you might be winning.
Wait, I got to.
It's the only time I would ever win it on a podcast, on stage.
I think that most of the time, when people wake up, the sun is out. And it would be great.
Exactly.
Right? The sun is already up. It's probably smart to really do this largely by when do kids go up to the bus stop? What is the earliest round of kids going up to the bus stop? And I believe that time is somewhere around 8:30 is when the earliest bus stops start to happen.
Right now?
No. Earliest bus stops are way before 8:30.
Yeah, wait, for who? That's because your kids aren't in high school yet, Jay.
Well, what's the height? Well, that's why I'm asking.
It keeps getting earlier.
6:45, 7, 6:30.
Okay, so why don't we have the sun rise at 7:15? Kids are on the bus at 7:30. It's light out when kids are going to the bus.
So you're making an argument for standard time.
For shifting.
Standard time, but with a very specific change to when sunrise happens to help kids get on the bus for school.
So you're actually talking not just about sticking to standard time, but potentially changing what time of day it is based on the
sun. I think Jay wants to change the orbit of the Earth.
No, because can we standardize what time the sun comes up around the clock?
No, because because we have time zones, as I just said, it's going to come up an hour later for people at opposite ends of the same time zone.
Yeah, the time zone is just a line, a literal geographic line, and you might be right on the edge of it.
And if you have mountains where you live, that delays sunrise too.
That's true.
Sure does. Yes.
So you can't standardize that, but you just have to pick. Do we want the sun to be rising earlier so that kids will have a greater chance of having daylight when they're getting on the bus, or do we want sun at the end of the day? That's basically
I think it's important for the sun to be up to some degree in the morning, right? So if kids are going to walk out to the
so move the school day,
then make school start later.
That's where
you have the control.
We already know that we should be doing that because kids will get more sleep and they do better in school and everything is
there
better. So if we do that, then we can do daylight saving time.
Okay.
Now here's just a couple of other things that hasn't been mentioned. So first of all, the Senate did debate this very question. They debated daylight saving time versus standard time. And they
chose daylight saving.
They chose daylight saving. That's because a lot of industries came in and said, we want daylight saving time. It's better for our industry. And that won the argument over kids getting to school safely.
Why was it better for their industries? Longer working days?
More sales. Maybe people farming, shop more. Well, farms, from what I understand, don't care because the cows get up when the sun does. They're kind of on solar time anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not as big a deal. But
so it's all capitalism, just consumption.
Yeah, basically.
Just more daylight to consume.
But here's the other point of view. So the review article I read said, the thing is, it's not that big a deal in a way because of LEDs, because of lighting. We actually have so much bright artificial lighting that our circadian rhythm isn't tied to the sun the way it used to be. It's really, we have more control over it because of artificial lighting. So it may not be that big of an issue. Hmm. You just light the streets and who cares, you know, if it's the sun's up or not. So anyway, it's complicated, as I said, and there really isn't any clear answer. And the thing is, we may need to tie other decisions to this decision. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my point. We can't do this in a vacuum. But I think that pick one, and I actually don't even really care. I think just pick one, and that's this time, and there's no change twice a year. And then hopefully the societal changes will adjust to it. And we'll find the balance in all of these things. But we don't
Bob
have
and Evan care.
You can't assume that everything else is going to stay the same and this is the only change we're going to make and it's got to work. And that's probably why it failed back in the 70s because they didn't otherwise adjust to the fact that they were not switching their clock. So in any way, I think that's the deeper discussion of it.
And I can imagine that there's like this huge listenership that doesn't fall within our ideal latitude band that's like... What are you talking about? I live in northern Scotland. The sun comes up at like 11 a.m. and sets at like 5 p.m. It's horrible.
And in the summer, it
like
too.
Stays up all day too.
Go
so
south.
Yeah, it's like we're kind of lucky in that we have that kind of classic 12 hours of sun, or I don't know what our standard hour, 8 to 12 over the course of the year.
It varies, based on the season. Yeah.
So what's likely to happen?
We're 9 to 15
I mean, they're not going to change all these schedules. They're not going to do the ultimate intelligent thing to do. They're going to change... They're going to get rid of daylight savings time, make it just the clock doesn't change, and then what are they not going to do that you think they should do?
Well, they're going to they're going to make daylight saving time permanent, right? That's
which means it'll be dark at the school at the bus stop.
Which means it'll be dark in the morning, even in the winter.
And then they're
months.
Not going to change the time that school starts.
And they should make school start later for multiple reasons
and they
could
see
won't.
The sunrise every day,
assuming it's not cloudy.
Yeah, it's a big social experiment. That's the bottom line.
Oh boy!
And I don't know that we could actually how much we could learn from what happened in the '70s.
Yeah, I didn't even know about that. Yeah. Like I only know of it because of all the people that wrote in to be like, "Don't you remember?"
Yeah, right.
No.
Back before that, we literally have what twice as much lighting than we did back then. I mean, it's a different world. It's a different world.
Right.
A whole new world.
There you go. All right. Let's go on to some news items. Jay, tell us about the moon rocket that's finally here.
Steve, did you know
Probably.
That a human has not been on the moon since 1972? We're talking about the early 70s. We're talking about like...
Right.
Daylight savings experiment
50 years.
The time that disco came into being... A person has not been on the moon. So NASA has finally, guys, oh my God, finally rolled out its Space Launch System, SLS, to the launch pad at Kennedy Space Center. This happened on Friday, March 18th. As you know, this has been in development since 2011, but this effort goes way back to when? You guys know when it really, really started?
2002.
2004. Good guess, Ed.
Wow.
NASA was asked by the President of the United States, George Bush, to go back to the moon and then Mars. So that's what got this whole thing rolling. The Orion program was then created in 2005, along with the then named Ares 1 rocket. This original rocket was then changed to the SLS, you know, because there was lots of like versioning and changes happening here.
Oh yeah.
But they settled on the SLS finally. This is a really big rocket, guys. It's coming in at 111.25 meters or 350 feet high. That's over what, 32 stories high? This is huge. This thing is enormous.
High.
You know, longer than a football field, huge. NASA is conducting critical tests on the rocket to prepare it for its likely late May, but most likely a June test launch. And that mission is called Artemis 1. That's the Artemis 1 mission, and we are actually going to live to see it. Even though it took longer than expected to develop, I think it's worth saying that there is a lot of great technology here, but there's a lot of reused technology in this build. I'm not sure you guys know about this. It borrows heavily from the Apollo missions and from the space shuttle missions. I mean, they're using like rocket engines that were on the shuttle, and they're using like designs that originated with the Apollo missions that they augmented. You know, again, I'm not saying that there isn't amazing technology here, because there is, but a lot of the build is a modern version of these older technologies. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. They didn't start from scratch because they were told not to start from scratch by Congress, right? They didn't want them to absolutely start from scratch. So they said, okay, well, let's take what we have that in what we built, which was very successful, and let's modernize it and version it to make it, you know, use modern ways of fabrication, modern materials, modern, you know, everything. They modernized the whole thing. So you could say, hey, that, you know, maybe that's not a great way to go, but it got them there. And, you know, NASA feels very, very strongly about what they've achieved. So let's dig into it. Are you guys ready?
Yep. Yes.
The rocket is at Launch Complex 39B at the Kennedy Space Center. I just love.
Not 39A.
No, they picked B. No, I love how complicated all of this is. You know, the machine that rolls out the space shuttle is the same machine that rolls out the SLS, like the same one. You know what I mean? Like this is this is the walker that they have. It's, you know,
if it ain't broke.
Yeah.
Why fix
but
it?
But it goes,
what you got.
It goes back to the 60s. You know what I'm saying? Like this is old technology, but it works. You know, why change it? During the next month, they will be conducting a fueling test. This test includes filling the rocket with its propellants, and then they run through the countdown launch system. This is called a wet dress rehearsal because of the propellants. Everything will be tested, including the Orion capsule itself and its software, all the ground systems, the launch tower, the entire rocket, right? This thing is, you know, they have probably thousands of ways of measuring things and levels and all that, right? They got to check everything. They have to, all the software has to be fully coordinated. The systems have to be flawlessly talking to each other. And this is when they test it. If they have any issues, this could easily extend the launch date. Because they're prepared to test this thing for a month on the launch pad. Once they complete all the tests, they'll bring the SLS back to the vehicle assembly building where they'll actually finish prepping it for launch, right? These are the final preparations that they do right before they do a launch. Again, if this final prep goes well and there's no issues to further delay the launch, they can wheel it back out and launch and get it ready for possibly, but very unlikely, late May, sometime in June.
Wow.
The SLS has two huge solid rocket boosters. The primary stage is filled with 733,000 gallons, 2.8 million liters of propellant. It's huge, guys. It's a monster. This thing will propel Orion through the Earth's atmosphere and into orbit. It's sole job. The SLS's upper stage, known as the Interim Cryogenic Propulsion Stage, ICPS, this will then take over and propel Orion towards the moon. After the Orion space capsule separates from the ICPS, it will be powered by the European service module that was built by the European Space Agency. The Artemis 1 mission is to fly the Orion capsule to the moon and stay in orbit for 6 days. And at that time, it will come back to the Earth and do its splashdown. Everything that's happening on this mission is a test, right? They're sending an Orion capsule to the moon with a you know, dummy in the pilot seat. They're going to be pretending that people are on board and testing everything and making sure that everything works. It's a 26-day mission. And I read that it could be even longer, that they could extend certain aspects of the mission. They haven't fully decided, and I don't know when they have to do the final decision making, but from very recent articles, they're saying 26-day, but could be even longer depending on what they want to do when they get out there. Every step of the way, NASA will be testing countless systems and procedures to ensure that they're ready for Artemis 2, because Artemis 2, as I hope everybody knows, this is the crewed mission to the moon. This is when the tires hit the pavement, guys. The SLS 2 mission, however, will not be putting people on the moon. They will just be doing a flyby of the moon. The SLS will be the biggest, most powerful rocket, probably, maybe, if not for a very long time. This could be the last gigantic rocket that's ever built. And you might ask why.
Why?
Because it's profoundly expensive. This system is not reusable. wait until I tell you how much it costs to just to do a mission, right? You know, SpaceX, the Starship will be able to lift just over half of what the SLS can do, but you know damn well that SpaceX's Starship missions are going to be reusable and be way less expensive, like way less expensive. Not to rain on this parade, but it's an incredibly expensive system to run, and it is unsustainable. I mean, we have like the people running NASA are saying it's unsustainable for the long haul. But in the short term, though, it's going to do some very important things, which we should be very happy about. And another cool thing about the SLS missions is that nations around the world will take part in going to the moon. We're going to take astronauts and you know, whatever they're called in the nation that they're from. But people that are going to navigate, circumnavigate space are going to be coming from all around the world to go to the moon. And I think it's something that unites the world. You know, this is a wonderful thing, especially in these times, right? In these times, like, you know, who knew 6 months ago when we were talking about SLS that there'd be a massive war going on? But we need good stuff like this happening, right? Mm-hmm. Since its beginnings, NASA has spent over $50 billion to engineer the entire Artemis program. Oh, yeah. That is massive amounts. Keeping in mind that $1 billion is $1,000 million, right? Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible just amount of money. Yeah, I just want you to put that into perspective. This includes
a thousandth of a trillion, but yeah, go ahead.
Like now, Jeff Bezos could barely afford it.
I know. Imagine that.
Barely.
Still, it still wouldn't change how, you know, his lavish lifestyle, though. This includes
he still can. Yeah.
This whole thing, though, of course, guys, there was a ton of new technology here. They had to invent a lot of things. For example, we've talked about it on the show before, but they came up with the new spacesuits. They put in an incredible amount of time, consideration, iterations, and a lot of money to bring that new technology into reality. I mean, it's just a staggering thing in order to, you know, to construct new spacesuits from the ground up.
Oh, yeah.
The innovations that they had to come up with, they are profound and they're legitimate. And I'm not trying to take away any of, you know, the wonderfulness of all of this, you know, but they did reuse a lot of technology, which, again, I'm not even sure if that's a bad thing. I'm just saying what it is. You know, the experts can comment on that. Beyond the build cost, in order to fly one mission a year, guys, it will take, Evan, drumroll, $4.1 billion a year. Where SpaceX,
it's nothing.
SpaceX,
you spend more on Halloween candy.
I know, but Steve, it adds up over time. You know, that $4.1 billion can turn into, you know, $100 billion. You know what I mean? Like, depending on how long this operates. And you know, I'm not throwing SpaceX in NASA's face, but SpaceX is doing it for hundreds of millions of dollars, and they might even get it down to below hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, as they ramp up and their reusability quotient increases. These missions are over 6 years behind schedule as well, and that costs a lot of money. NASA expects to have the crewed Artemis 2 mission in 2024. And like Artemis 1, that's going to orbit the moon. But then in 2025 or 26, the Artemis 3 mission intends to land on the moon. And this, guys, it's not far away. It's just not far away anymore.
Yeah, 4 years.
Yep, that's going to go by very quick. These missions are a big deal because NASA intends to build habitats and infrastructure and orbit around the moon and on the moon's surface. I mean, there's going to be people living on the moon. NASA has really leveled this time. Yeah. And all of this is a precursor to turning their eye towards Mars. It's really looking like we're going to have human beings on Mars within a reasonable amount of time.
All right. Well put, I guess.
A couple of points. One thing, you can't really compare, you know, the NASA program to SpaceX. The whole point is that NASA's doing the new difficult stuff and paving the way for private industry to come in behind and make things faster, cheaper, whatever.
Right.
So
iterate.
Yeah, it's not, you can't compare the two. It's not really fair. The SpaceX would not be where it is had not NASA spent billions of dollars blazing that trail to begin with.
Also, to be fair, NASA is paying SpaceX too. Yeah.
But NASA did something very, very smart with the Artemis program. There are contractors in all 50 states responsible for about 70,000 employees. Mm-hmm. Working on, you know, the various aspects of Artemis. That means that every single senator has a stake.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I love it.
And so both wanting to see this go.
Obama and Trump tried to reduce the budget, and the Congress would not let them do it.
Yeah.
because of that. So they were. I don't know how deliberate that was, but that was the result. And I
gotta be.
I think it was, there was probably, I mean, you know, all 50 states sounds like they made an effort to like spread it out to make sure that they had continued support, and it worked. All right, Kara, tell us about the effects of COVID on the brain.
Uh-oh. Ooh, yeah. Uh-oh. And so this is only one piece of the puzzle. The puzzle of what happens to your brain. This is your brain on COVID. A new study was just published earlier this month in Nature. SARS-CoV-2 is associated with changes in brain structure in UK Biobank. And I think an operative word in that headline is the UK Biobank. So for those who don't know what the UK Biobank is, a little background, and I'm going to take this straight from the Biobank website. The UK Biobank is a large-scale biomedical database and research resource containing in-depth genetic and health information from 500,000 UK participants. So this is a massive database that's regularly added to. It's globally accessible for approved researchers. And a lot of really important takeaways have come from this very useful database of ongoing health information. So what did these researchers do? Well, they go, a lot of people are getting COVID. We have this database full of information. A bunch of people in the database got brain scans, like total brain scans, at certain points in time. There happened to be a global pandemic, which means randomly, a certain percentage of those people who got these brain scans at different points in time got COVID in between. So what information can we glean from that? So it's really interesting. It's, you know, it's sort of a convenient sample, but that convenient sample is actually really, really robust. So they looked at 785 participants who had had two different MRI scans. And between those scans, 401 of them had COVID, 384 of them did not have COVID. And they played with the statistics a little, like they compared them based on with no kind of accounting for severity. They also looked at it after taking out the people who had been hospitalized. So really they were looking at more, I guess you could call mild to moderate COVID as opposed to severe COVID. And they said, let's look at those brain scans and just see if they're different. Let's see if there's any changes. And what they found was that on average, there was a significant difference in the gray matter. And we're talking about the gray matter density, like the actual amount of gray matter. And of course, gray matter is like the cell bodies, the neural cell bodies where they cluster together, the squishy parts of your brain, as opposed to white matter, which are the axons and the sort of the tracks, the nerves. And so after COVID-19, on average, there was a significant reduction in gray matter in the parts of the brain that tend to be associated with smell. So let's talk about, you know, and we know that COVID affects smell. And we just a couple weeks ago, I did a story about what's actually happening at the kind of cellular level, right? And the genetic level. They found that reduction in gray matter thickness in both the orbitofrontal cortex and the parahippocampal gyrus. Now, both of these areas are involved in smell. They're also involved in a hell of a lot of other stuff. But yes, they're involved in smell. They also found actual markers of tissue damage in regions that are actually physically connected to the primary olfactory cortex, so the main kind of smelling cortex in the brain. And they did find, on average, that the brains of people post-COVID were reduced in size.
Everybody? What do you think? Even if you had a light case?
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. They took out the 15 hospitalized patients and then reanalyzed, and they still found those things to hold true. But what do you think happened in the media when this paper was published?
You mean besides getting it wrong?
Right. Like, what do you think most of the coverage said?
That your brain shrinks when you get COVID.
That your brain shrinks, yeah. Or that COVID gives you brain damage. Or that COVID directly leads to, yeah, rotting of the brain, shrinking of the brain, withering of the brain. But what we have to remember is that your brain is constantly changing. Constantly. And, like, literally everything makes your brain change. Like, learning. Learning makes your brain. Reading books, doing puzzles, mm-hmm. watching television,
remembering.
Engaging in conversations, remembering. Not remembering, having an infection, working out, right? All of these things contribute to brain change. And when we're able to really look with a fine-tooth comb, when we have really, really high resolution, we're going to notice stuff. And so the big kind of question here, and the authors leave this as an open question, is we don't know if this is actually A, permanent, We still need to do follow-ups of these very same people months and years later. Did those changes go back? Did they change in a different direction? Did they hold? And also, are those changes linked to functionality? So we do know that there is a correlation here, because we know that when people get COVID, they often lose their sense of smell. We also see brain changes, and specifically reduction in gray matter density or thickness in these very specific regions that we already know are associated with smell. So the question is this just a disuse thing, right? The whole time you can't smell, you're not getting smell inputs. Are the brain regions that usually process smells and process memories and smells and connect smells to all these other functions just not being used? And then when we get our smell back again, do they just kind of bounce right back?
And
we don't know.
But there are other cases, in other words, non-COVID related, in which things like that have happened, in which people have lost their sense, but it has come back.
Yeah, there are literally studies showing that if you have a stuffy nose, the brain regions involved in smell change.
Oh, gee whiz. So that's very slight. I mean, you know, the slightest external force can change this whole thing. So
your brain is very, very plastic. And I think that's why it's important. I'm not downplaying the fact that there may be something interesting here. They really were able to, like, this is a really robust study, and they were able to look at this data in a very fine-toothed way, and really make some good observations. What those observations mean, we still need to do more work here. How we interpret these results, I think, is important. So we do know that COVID changes the brain. We do know specifically that, on average, COVID changes the brain in regions that are associated with smelling. We don't yet know if those changes are permanent. We don't yet know if those changes actually are linked to any sort of outcome functions. And we don't yet know if those changes are significant or severe. I mean, they're significant insofar as they are statistically significant, but we don't really know the global impact of that. There's still more to learn, but it is interesting to see that we can measurably notice changes in people's brains immediately after COVID.
You know, is this something to be worried about? Like, lots of us got COVID.
I think probably, I mean, that's a kind of a loaded question. I think that once we see more downstream results, we'll better be able to answer that question.
Steve, would you be able to notice a slight dip in brain functionality?
What do you mean by notice? So
measure.
There's different measures different than notice, right?
I'm talking about me, like sitting here. I got COVID, right? I'm not trying to be sound selfish. I'm using myself as an example. In my day-to-day life, like, is there any way I can kind of test myself to see, hey, like, maybe I took a hit from COVID, you know, from a mental perspective?
So, you know, that depends on what your baseline is. The more high functioning you are intellectually at baseline, the more subtle a deficit you will notice. We will be able to detect it on, like, standardized testing before you will notice it in your day-to-day life. So there's different thresholds, you know, to test.
Yeah, but that also assumes that you'd have a pretest level.
Right.
Well, that's what I know, but whether or not you have it, that's that you could detect it if you did a pre and post test, right? Which would be hard to do, because why would somebody get a pretest before COVID?
Yeah.
Like, right. We can sort of estimate premorbid functioning, usually with bigger, you know, with like bigger insults. We can estimate premorbid functioning, but it's really just an estimation.
Yeah, and it's subjective, if you don't have have numbers. Like, you didn't do a test. Like, if you are like a college professor who has to give lectures, you know, then you may notice that it's a little bit harder to do that. If you have a job that is not cognitively demanding, you may not notice, you know, a little bit of a hit. So that depends, you know. But
and so that, Jay, that is what neuropsychologists do.
Yeah.
Like, that is their bread and butter, is they do assessment. So somebody comes in, they're worried that their memory's starting to go, or they've just had a brain injury, or, you know, whatever the case may be. We actually have a long COVID clinic at the hospital where I work. And so people come in and they get a neuropsychological battery, a bunch of different standardized assessments that are normed to their age and education level. And based on how they perform on those tests, we can say, not only are you performing like lower than average or higher than average, you know, you have strengths and weaknesses in these areas. We can also say you have relative strengths and weaknesses, you know, compared to your kind of global performance in this area, you struggle. Like, your baseline is not your baseline, but your sort of like overall performance is here. But compared to your overall performance over here, you're struggling. But over here, you're really kicking ass.
Yeah.
And so, but really, what does that mean? from a behavioral perspective, it can inform diagnoses, right? A lot of neuropsychologists work with neurologists who also are looking at imaging to be able to inform a diagnosis and maybe a treatment protocol. A lot of it is about rehab strategies. It's about, you know, what are some of the functional ways that we can adapt to this change if we're struggling with memory, if we're struggling with cognition, you know, and the tests are so sensitive that they give neuropsychologists really specific information to say, you may find this type of job difficult, or in these types of settings, it may benefit you to use these tools. And that's really what it comes down to.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Let's talk about the origin of life, not the evolution of life, but the origin of life. Two different things.
How, is that abiogenesis?
Abiogenesis. How did life come from non-life? So this is obviously one of the deep, you know, unanswered questions in science. I don't like to say it's a mystery because it's not really a mystery. It's just that we haven't answered the question yet. But we are making progress, and there's certainly a lot of plausible hypotheses out there about how it could have come about. Recent study adds one tiny piece to our, you know, evolving picture of what could have happened or what's plausible, but I'll build up to that. The basic idea about how life could have developed out of non-life is that it started with what scientists call a replicator, right? Some molecule able to replicate itself. And in that replication process, there would be the introduction of some variability. And that would allow for there to be selective pressures that would favor certain versions of the molecule over others. Once you have that, you know, you have basically a toehold in evolution. But even still, there's a lot of steps between a replicator and a single living cell, right?
Okay.
So, and it's, you know, so there's lots of candidate replicators. You know, once you have a single living cell, you're off to the races in terms of evolution. Trying to connect the dots between that molecule, replicator molecule, and a single, you know, what we would consider that's clearly alive. That is a living cell. That's where, you know, we have only, you know, a scant idea what could have happened and what actually did happen.
So are we talking like, what are we talking, like ribosomes? Like, so, are we talking like...
So let's talk about that.
What's the... Okay.
So what's the replicator? There's three main candidates for what the original replicator could have been. DNA, RNA, and proteins, right?
Yeah.
Perhaps the leading candidate right now is RNA. And this is the RNA world theory, right? Where you had, you know, for a while, there was just RNA. And
how long?
Was,
a few weeks? Month?
Yeah, or millions of
years.
Give
or take a billion.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And so that RNA was the original replicator molecule, right? So that's one theory. So the study that I'm going to talk about is building on that notion. It's a study of RNA. Now, one of the questions, there's lots of questions, but one of the questions with, you know, going from RNA world to life is, could multiple different versions of RNA have coexisted? Because one theory is that two different things, right, whether they're organisms or self-replicating molecules, couldn't occupy the exact same niche because they would be competing for the same resources. And so one would, whichever one had even a slight evolutionary advantage over the other, it would predominate. So you're always going to end up with just like in any niche, you're going to have one thing filling that space. But we don't really know that that's true. That's just, you know, that is something that is generally observed in nature, but it's not necessarily an absolute rule, right? So that's one thing that the researchers wanted to test. They also wanted to see if RNA itself could evolve, in, you know, could be... could change over time in response to selective pressure. So what they did was they purified an RNA molecule from a bacteria, and they made what they call a self-coded RNA replicase, right? So the chunk of RNA that they started with had code for RNA replicase. Right, so it coded for the protein that it needed to replicate itself. So you have a self-replicating chunk of RNA.
Mm-hmm.
And then they basically said, okay, now let's see what happens, right?
So let it loose.
they gave it raw material.
Did they give any thought of how that could have gotten there?
No. You know, so
the first replicator? It's
starting with that, right? So again, when this kind of research comes up, the deniers, if you will, can always say what the research didn't show. And that instantly happened in the comments to my blog when I wrote about this. But because there's so many different steps, you have to sort of break it down and say, we're going to study this step just to see,
right,
as a proof of concept, can we get from D to E? Forget about A, B, C. Forget about everything after that. I just want to know, can we get from D to E? You know, that's what the study is showing. And to say, well, it didn't show all the steps leading up to and following. Of course it didn't. It wasn't designed to look at that. And you know,
right, that wasn't the hypothesis.
It's not the question, right. It's not the question trying to answer.
And if you're waiting for us to evolve life in a petri dish, keep waiting, because that's not going to happen. You know, we're talking about something that happened in the oceans of the world over millions of years. And so that's not going to happen. We're not going to be able, you know, maybe we might simulate it one day in a quantum computer simulator.
Oh, we will.
But we're not going to reproduce it. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's going to be a really important line of evidence going forward. But so anyway, they wanted to know what happens if we somehow get to that self-replicating RNA, you know, molecule. What's next, right?
So because and to be clear, right, the naysayers, quote unquote, are asking a disingenuous question,
yes,
because they're operating on the assumption that life was created and did not spontaneously
evolve,
but that abiogenesis, they're operating on the assumption that what we're talking about here didn't even happen.
Mm. Yeah.
So they're trying to find holes in the argument. Whereas all the scientists are saying, well, we know this happened. We got to figure out how.
That's a very common rhetorical device. You should keep your, you know, that's like a name that logical fallacy kind of thing. It's very, very common to say what, like, a study is not showing when it's not relevant to what the study was looking at. Or like saying, well, random mutation can't, this is a very common creationist sort of talking point, like natural selection can't create increased information and mutations are unguided. So therefore evolution can't happen. It's like, well, yeah, but it's the natural selection that's guiding it and the mutations that are causing the increase in variation. So
it's like, know, there's no context in your claim at all.
Yeah. No, it's exactly like saying, well, an engine can't steer the car and the steering wheel can't propel the car, so cars don't work. That's exactly what that is doing.
Screw
that. Anyway, what they found was, here's a quote now from the article, the RNA diversifies into multiple coexisting host and parasite lineages whose frequencies in the population initially fluctuate and gradually stabilize. The final population comprising five RNA lineages forms a replicator network with diverse interactions, including cooperation to help the replication of all other members.
Nice.
The network develops.
And that just spontaneously happens?
Yes. That's very interesting. So,
yeah.
So again, is this proof that this is how life evolved? Of course not. It's looking at one tiny slice of a very complicated multi-step process, but it shows that multiple RNA lineages can coexist, that they can form a network where they're sort of working off of each other, cooperating in a way.
Symbiotic.
It's symbiotically, and sometimes parasitically, which of course we all know that happens. Or there may have been quote unquote viruses before there were even cells. Think about that. There was parasitic. Mm. What's parasitic RNA other than a virus, right? So, sure.
It's cool. It's like you can't prove a positive, right? Like we can't say this is proof of how this happened back then. But what we can say is this provides evidence that it could have happened.
Right.
That's one possible scenario.
We can't disprove that it could have happened this way. That's what this research is focused on. What could have happened?
Yeah.
Not what did happen. We don't know what happened. We can't go back in time. Maybe one day we'll be able to look at other evolutionary systems at different stages, when we travel to other worlds. But for now, what do we got? We have proof of concept. This is what could happen. And maybe simulations, computer simulations. That's pretty much it, But there's no way to go back and look and say what actually did happen. I mean, we may be able to infer it in some way.
Yeah, there might be some clues that really strongly point one way or the other. But
that's it. So this answers a specific question. Can multiple lineages of RNA coexist even in the same niche, off building off the same resources? It also showed something very interesting, and that is these RNA molecules evolved, right? They were able to produce variation. There were selective pressures involved. They changed over time. They reached an equilibrium in their environment, and you know, with multiple, you know, different lineages coexisting and even cooperating. So that, I think, really raises the plausibility of RNA world as the origin of life, you know, as a possible pathway.
Well, so why, Steve? Why is it so important and good that you could have cooperating lineages instead of one lineage? Why is that so much better than the other? And what would you be saying if they showed that only one lineage could really predominate?
Well, again, it's more, you know, what is the more likely pathway? Like, what's a plausible pathway? This is what happens, you know, when they do that. It does create, it does increase the probability that interesting stuff can happen, you know, when there's multiple different lineages. You could argue that the more important piece was the fact that they responded to selective pressures, you know, that they were able to not only self-replicate,
but
change over time, right? So the idea that a replicator is a stepping stone to life is supported by these results. But again, it's a tiny sliver of a very long process. But so far, you know, like, we keep asking questions about, could the building blocks of life spontaneously form out of just raw material? And the answer is, yeah, it can be. And, you know, can these things self-replicate? Can these things, you know, interact with each other? Can they evolve over time? Like, these questions are all turning out in the positive. And it does seem like there's a pretty plausible pathway for the emergence of life. These kinds of molecules will spontaneously emerge. These kind of molecules can evolve. And, you know, forming a cell is probably not that hard. You know, by lipid, you know, two lipid layers.
Oh, it happens spontaneously if you just drop oil. Yeah,
exactly. It happens spontaneously.
Yeah, right.
So you have all these bubbles, basically the cell membranes floating around. And if a cooperative, you know, system of RNA molecules gets inside of one, that could have advantages and disadvantages, right? It's like, okay, now it's sort of protected. It might be able to sequester its resources so that it's a way of competing with other things. But then it needs to find some way to both get resources into its bubble and excrete waste out of its bubble. And now also the proteins that it's making could then lodge into the bilipid layer and make a functional membrane to do these things. And before you know it, you have a cell.
Yeah, a cell with like capabilities and properties.
Exactly. All right, Bob, tell us about orbiting solar power. We have spoken about this before on the show, but it's been a long time. So give us the update.
Okay. This update is a little specific. The UK government is reportedly evaluating a 16 billion pound proposal, and that's not how much it weighs, to construct a solar power station in orbit around the Earth. So as we have mentioned it before, the idea at its most basic is to collect energy in space from the sun and beam it back to Earth and use it, add it to the grid. Simple. George Freeman, the UK's Minister for Science, Research and Innovation and Muggles, is said to be meeting with a group to discuss this possibility and would possibly commit to at least a huge chunk of money with the implied hope that other countries would join in. Freeman said to potential private investors and engineers in Westminster recently that this is being taken very seriously. We're up for being bold, and we're not going to be able to fund the whole thing, but we're up for supporting ecosystems like this. So that's nice. So the whole idea of space-based solar power, SBSP, it goes back to the mid-1920s at least. Russian scientist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, the father of Russian space, is ostensibly the first person to voice such an idea. And then he, of course, inspired many sci-fi writers like Isaac Asimov. And, for example, his enjoyable 1941 short story Reason used this idea. Fun story. I recommend it. Since then, space-based solar power has been increasingly taken seriously scientifically. And over the years and across the globe, there's been various committee, agency, departmental, and governmental examinations, petitions, declarations, studies, plans, reports, proposals, research, announcements, patents, and small-scale technology demos. So yeah, this idea has been bandied about for decades. Is it going to happen? What's going to happen? How is it going to happen? The advantage of the space-based solar power, though, is pretty obvious if you think about it. When you compare it to solar panels on Earth and other renewables like wind, as sophisticated as they're becoming, You've got near 24/7 access to the sun in space with no dips due to the sun setting or horrible overcast weather. And there's also the added bonus I hadn't heard of before of capturing even more solar energy that bounces back off the Earth's atmosphere. So that could also be just a little extra icing on the cake. Now, the disadvantages, though, I think are equally obvious. The biggest has always been the cost, right? Since the day we launched the first of anything into orbit, it's just been way too expensive to throw even tiny amounts of mass to even the lowest of low Earth orbits. It's just like so crazy expensive. Now, of course, if you've been following the space industry the past decade, it's really the cost per kilogram or per pound has dropped precipitously, especially in the past 5 years. And some countries think it's time to really, really start considering or even planning such projects dealing with space-based solar power. Now, the UK's current plan, they already have a plan that's fairly, you know, that's fleshed out to a certain degree. They call it the Space Energy Initiative, and that's part of the government's Net Zero Innovation Portfolio, which they want to use to help achieve net zero for them by 2050, which, of course, is a very laudable goal. Absolutely. So the current thinking is that such a satellite would be, get this, 4.8 kilometers or 3 miles long, weighing several thousand tons, and being assembled by robots in orbit.
Cool.
What orbit, Bob, did they say?
My research didn't show any specifics beyond the fact that you would have access to the sun like 99% of the time. Yeah. So that probably would inform us about the orbit if I dug that deep about that.
Yeah, it's probably a medium to high orbit would be my
yeah.
So we can't service it easily, but the robots would do the service.
Yeah, unless you have robots.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
Now, the supporters of the project say that radical thinking is needed for the world to meet net zero requirements. The Times in the UK's report on this topic, which is like the only one that really had any decent detail, and I had to pay for a trial period for this newspaper, so I hope it's actually good because I'm kind of committed for a little while. So it said,
I know that frustration. That's
right. It's the first time I really had to like pay money to get some damn research. So large reflectors would direct sunlight onto solar panels. The power they produce would be converted into high frequency radio waves and beamed to an ellipse shaped receiving station at ground level, possibly at sea, which would be around 13 kilometers long and 6.5 kilometers wide. That's 8 miles by 4 miles. The beam itself, it wouldn't be some death beam, you know, immediately giving you skin cancer or to anyone who crossed the path of the beam. It would really only be about a quarter as intense as the equator's sun, or so they claim. So that's pretty negligible. They do claim, though, that the more research is needed to see how the beam might affect aircraft communication. So that sounds fair, right? We've been talking about that enough lately. Now, one of these satellite stations they claim would provide 2 gigawatts of AC power into the grid, which is nice. That's actually really nice. If you look at the average, I did some research, the average nuclear power plant is about a gigawatt. So this is like double the average. So it's a good nuclear power station equivalent there. The Space Energy Initiative co-chair Martin Saltow said that 15 of these satellites would fill 30% of the UK's electricity needs or the anticipated needs by mid-2040. 15 of those.
Wait, 15 and with 15 of these also separate bases kind of on the Earth
I think so. I'm not sure, though, if you need separate bases, but I think you might need 15 separate ones. Or maybe they could double up on each other.
At
I'm not
6
sure.
kilometers each?
Dude, it's a little
that's,
wacky.
That's so massive.
Yeah, and advisory board chair Mark Garnier said, "We all recognize the urgent need to think big and act now to reduce our reliance on carbon fuels to better protect the environment and our precious climate." Okay, so that's pretty much all the facts I wanted to convey there. So here's my take on this. Now, I totally agree. We need to think big and act now, obviously. Yes, we need a sense of urgency, and being bold is becoming increasingly critical if we want to really, you know, mitigate climate change. And of course, I have to say that orbiting solar power stations are awesome. They're great. And I'm psyched that we actually are close enough technology wise where it's feasible, although probably quite expensive still. Mm. Taking this proposal, this specific proposal in isolation, and when I was thinking about it, to me, it just sounded really wacky and, you know, even just way overconfident, I think. If you think about it, think of what I had just said. Each satellite is 5 kilometers long, several thousand tons each, and they're built by frickin' robots in space. Has anything been ever built by robots in space? No. They've assisted and they do certain things, but we've never had anything built by robots as structures, especially kilometers long, right?
Hey, Bob, you don't sound like yourself.
I know. I'm just saying. I mean, if you've got an urgent task that needs to be accomplished, I wouldn't be relying on using robots in space building things that are kilometers long. 13 kilometers by 6.5 kilometers. That's the receiving station. Would we need 15 of those? Maybe. I mean, maybe they could double up. I don't know. And 15 of them would give us 30%, just 30% of coverage, and all by the mid-2040s. And the real icing on the cake for me was with the quote when they compared it to a nuclear power station built by humans on the ground. And it made me think that, you know, why not just build a lot of nuclear power stations? That's got to be a lot easier and a lot quicker than doing this. But then I calmed down a little bit and I looked at their net zero innovation portfolio itself. And in that context, it sounds more reasonable as a component, right? Because their portfolio has lots of interesting things. Future, like offshore wind, nuclear advanced modular reactors. I think modular reactors are a fantastic idea. I can't wait to they actually really start getting into that. But also bioenergy, hydrogen, atmospheric greenhouse removal, advanced carbon capture, disruptive technologies, my favorite kind of technologies, disruptive technologies, all these things. Yeah. All these things that they're considering. So if you throw in this space-based solar power, it's just like, okay, that sounds more reasonable. I mean, I would focus a lot, you know, I would probably focus in terms of like the share. I would put a lot more money into the nuclear reactors and things. But I think eventually it may be reasonable to really, you know, have these satellites in orbit. Although I heard no numbers in terms of what's this going to cost to lift these behemoths into orbit. It may, even with Elon, you know, Elon Musk's SpaceX and the savings that he's bringing to bear, which they actually mentioned, they commissioned a feasibility report and they mentioned that private contractors like SpaceX could bring cost levels down to a level where it would make economic sense. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it still would be stupid expensive to even loft that much into orbit. It may still not be reasonable. I haven't seen any of their numbers about that.
And Bob, we need to calculate the carbon footprint of launching that into space.
Exactly.
Versus the power we would get out of it.
Exactly.
It may not be carbon efficient.
And building these structures on the planet.
Exactly. That's got to be factored. They actually, to be fair, they mentioned that, Steve. Precisely. They mentioned that you've got to factor that in so that it's not lost to them, or at least to the author of the article so that I read. But yeah, you got to factor that in as well. Yeah, I fear it may not really be a reasonable project. Even for the next 20 years, you know,
Does this thing degrade over time? Is it good for 20 years, 50 years, 100 years?
It will degrade faster than on the Earth because you're subjected to the, you know, to outer space. And, you know, these materials will definitely degrade in some ways faster than on the ground. Mm. You know, there is no weather, but you know, there is space weather. And that's nasty. So there's that as well. And then there's maintenance and repairs. And how about this? I mean, how hard would it be? You know, you've got 30% of your country's electricity is because of 15 of these satellites that could be destroyed in an afternoon. You know, you get some satellite collisions that have debris that wipe out everything. Or you have laser systems that blow them up. You know, right. one shot.
Bad rogue country.
And that's it. There's 30% of your electrical production. That to me, they're way too vulnerable.
You know,
very vulnerable. Whereas if you had, you know, these modular reactors, you could have modular nuclear reactors underground that would be much harder, a much more difficult target to take out than these things, you know, in orbit. So you got to consider that as well. So it's interesting. I'm glad that they're looking at this type of technology and factoring it into their portfolio. But I don't know, you know, if in 20, even in 20 years, you know, how far we would get with that. I think.
Yeah, this not by 2050. Not by 2050. Right. I think this is a technology for next century, honestly, to be honest with you. Maybe the end of this century. I think that we need solar panels that are going to be at the 40% or 50% efficiency rate, not the 22 or 3 or 4 that we're dealing with now. I think they've got to be much more resilient. They got to last 30, 40 years.
Right.
Not the,
They are very light. They did focus. They have some good studies showing how light they can be. But still, yeah, more efficient and even lighter.
Cost of getting stuff to So space has got to go down.
Yes.
There's a lot of things that have to have happened before this really becomes cost and carbon efficient enough to be worth the risk, as you say, the vulnerability of having up there. It's a cool idea. Here's the other thing, is that the efficiency of the radio waves as a transfer of energy is really tiny. That's the limiting step right there.
Yeah.
I think we need to figure out a way of getting a much greater percentage of that energy that it's collecting down to the ground. Otherwise, it's not worth it.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Evan, this is kind of related because it's, a global warming themed news item. Tell us about recent temperatures in the Antarctic.
Yeah. Well, you're familiar with the expression, numbers don't lie, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know who supposedly is the first person to had coined that expression?
Mark Twain, Albert Einstein.
Of course, that's what everybody said. Yeah. They did think for a while. It actually they can trace it back to 1852, so that's pre-Twain.
Really?
Yeah. Someone in Congress said, I will say here that hasty errors and hasty letters ought to be carefully avoided, particularly in matters of arithmetic, for unfortunately, figures never lie, though men sometimes do. Unattributed, someone in Congress said that in 1852, U.S. Congress. But in any case, temperature readings, I think that's about as universally accepted as any measurement. In other words, there's no partisan issue here. It's not political, right? The temperature is the temperature. And when they informed us this past week that the measurements of the surface temperatures of parts of the Antarctic are far above the normal temperature ranges for those regions at this time of year, I think we have a right to be concerned about that. And you may have read about this on March 18th. Experts from the Concordia Research Facility in Antarctica's Dome C, which is located 3,000 meters above sea level, measured a temperature of negative 11.5 degrees Celsius. That's 11 degrees Fahrenheit. And yeah, that sounds cold in a, you know, for us who live in the warmer climates. But for down there, that is outright beyond balmy. There are another station, Dumont d'Urville Observation Station in Antarctica. They recorded a record high temperature in March as well, 4.9 degrees Celsius. That's 41 degrees Fahrenheit. So must be on kind of the outer fringes of Antarctica. This is unprecedented. We're talking about measurements representing a 40 degrees Celsius above normal reading.
That's huge.
That's incredible.
That is ginormous. It really wasn't just this sudden blip or anomalous spike that took place over the course of, you know, an hour or, you know, 2 hours or something. That was an average temperature increase that occurred over a three-day period. One person, geoscientist Jonathan Weil, shared on his Twitter that the temperature measured was 1.5 degrees Celsius higher than the previous record. So these are record-setting temperatures that they're talking about. It's completely unprecedented, he's quoted as saying. And it upends our expectations about the Antarctic climate system. Antarctic climatology has been rewritten, said Stefano Di Battista, who's a researcher who has published studies on Antarctic temperatures, and has said that such anomalies would have been considered impossible and unthinkable before they actually occurred. Okay, but what caused it? Here's what they think caused it. Atmospheric rivers. Have we talked about this on the show before?
I don't think so, Ev.
I don't think so.
So, we know what rivers are, water rivers, you know, the Amazon or whatnot. But in the atmosphere has rivers. And these were discovered in the late 1990s. So it's sort of a recent discovery.
Yeah, they're fascinating. Look them up.
Water vapor in the atmosphere moving around in river with river-like qualities. But they're spread out. These particles of water vapor spread out sometimes 100 miles wide and many thousands of feet thick. If you were to condense all that water, it would be about 1 inch thick stream of water, right? So you're talking about something that's very spread out, yet it still has an enormous impact. And I watched a lot of videos about how these atmospheric rivers impact California climate. They come in off the Pacific, right? They form in the tropical climates, okay, and then they come and they roll in onto the surface. And when they do, they basically condense at that point because of the mountain ranges and water occurs. And sometimes it's nice because they have enough water to fill reservoirs and, you know, the needed water we need. But sometimes they're so intense that it absolute flooding occurs, devastating mudslides and everything else associated with them. And it's these atmospheric rivers that when they come out off the water and hit the land masses and the condensation occurs, boom, you get that kind of flooding in this case. Well, Antarctica had one of these now, which is not all that unusual. They know about atmospheric rivers that approach Antarctica and go over Antarctica, but they normally disperse. What was different about this particular one, apparently, is that there was a high pressure system which was sitting tight in one position. And so this river basically was crashing into it, causing a lot of rainfall and freezing rain to fall. And that was it. And you had it over the course of 3 days, and that was enough to change the temperatures so drastically. Now, they're saying that they're not sure if this new trend is something of an oddity or is something that is going to be more prevalent as the climate continues to change. They still, the jury is still out on that. They're still studying it. So they're not saying this is directly evidence of climate change, but it would be, you know, obviously you have to take climate change into consideration. And is this going to be a more common event that occurs and sort of speed up the overall warming that is going on as a result and kind of just making things worse?
Yeah. So did you mention that it's coming from Australia?
No, I hadn't mentioned it.
I knew it.
Yeah, that's not that it matters.
I knew it.
The river of warmth is coming down from Australia to the mm-hmm. the northern part of, well, I guess they're all the northern part of Australia, of Antarctica.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I guess the entire shoreline is north of the South Pole. But yeah, it's hitting, the part that's just below Australia.
And so these rivers all form in the tropical areas of the world, and they spread out. And they've done a pretty good job of mapping these. A lot of good videos on YouTube if you want to look up more information about atmospheric rivers. It really is fascinating. Right. So that they believe that that's what happened, and hence that 3 day spike in those temperatures,
unprecedented in 66 years of recording temperatures at that station.
Yep, at that station and multiple stations, including Vostok also took mm-hmm. much higher measurements for temperatures
so
for those days.
What's it going to take to get the world to finally mobilize and say, we've got to...
We don't know yet because it hasn't happened.
Yep. Yeah,
I know. Now we've got the war in Ukraine. Everyone's like completely distracted from climate change. Pump more oil. All right, but not to go down that rabbit hole. Jay.
Steve.
Is Who's That Noisy Time?
Guys, last week I played this noisy. Any guesses?
Minox feeding on the cables.
So close.
Chewie, go outside and clear them out.
Oh my God.
Thank you.
Nice.
Does it have something to do with space?
No.
What about spice?
Many people thought that this was a spacecraft. Let's talk about it. So William Steele wrote in. He said, "Hi, Jay. My guess for this week's is some sort of rocket fuel oxidizer tank venting. If I had to be more specific, I would say it is related to NASA's space launch system. It's a good guess because it certainly does sound spacecraftian, but it isn't." Thank you for writing that in. Shane Hillier said, "Hey, Jay, is that the sound of a fusion reactor in operation?" No, that is not a fusion reactor in operation. But again, you know, think about the variation we have here. We have a spaceship to a fusion reactor. Next guest here is Tony Bedford. He says, "Jay, I think it's the birth of an iceberg, a glacial ice shelf toppling into the ocean, caught on camera by someone on a boat. P.S. If you say I'm wrong, then you're a global warming denier, Chief."
There you go.
So we have, Tony, you are not correct. Now we have an iceberg, a fusion reactor, and we have some sort of spaceship rocket fuel oxidizer tank venting. Those are our guesses so far. Let me read one more guess to you guys. This is from Michael Blaney, and he says, "Hi, Jay, cool sound. My first thought, not my guess, was the sound of a meteorite breaking up as it enters the atmosphere." But then I thought, there's no way to record that, which is so true, right? I mean, how are you going to record that sound? So instead, my actual guess is an artificial satellite or rocket segment breaking up on re-entry that someone thought to mount a microphone on. That's a really cool guess. These are all perfectly good guesses. None of them were correct. There was no winner this week, guys.
Mm.
But I will tell you the reveal. This is pretty interesting. What you are hearing is someone driving a nail through a lithium ion battery.
Why the heck would you do that?
Because they test
noisy.
They test these batteries to see what it takes to puncture them, what happens when they get punctured. You know, there's lots of reasons. Like, you know, there's material inside of that battery.
So it's not some TikTok challenge random thing. Okay, good.
No, this is a legit thing, you know, tested by a battery manufacturer. Let me play it for you again. What you're hearing, there's a short in the anode and cathode layer. And it puts the cell into something called thermal runaway, which basically produces fireworks. And it is a pretty dramatic thing when you see it. There's plenty of videos on YouTube where you could see a cell phone, you know, essentially catching on fire and, you know, like the fireworks that come out of a cell phone battery when something horrible happens. But there's an incredible amount of energy that can be stored inside of a fully charged battery, right? And this is all of that energy being expelled, you know, in seconds. So take a listen again. They drive a nail through. That's the puncture sound in the very beginning. And the rest of it is basically the chemical and you know, fire and fireworks that happen afterwards. I mean, all kidding aside, man, do you not want this to happen in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really don't want that to happen. And, you know, it doesn't happen that often. It really doesn't happen often. I have a new noisy for everybody in the entire world this week. Okay. Here is this week's new noisy sent in by a listener named Daniel. I'm going to give a note here. I promised that I would do this many moons ago. I said that if I'm playing something that is a sonification, I would tell you this is a sonification. Do you know what that is, guys?
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
I don't. Oh. What is a sonification?
It is some sort of data that has been turned into sound.
Oh, like soundification, sonification.
Yeah, so like as an example, a very, very popular one that I've gotten sent, you know, hundreds of times is there's a picture of a star field, some portion of outer space somewhere that's showing individual stars and galaxies and all that stuff. And then there's like a laser light that goes across the picture, and every time it hits a light spot on the picture, it makes a noise. And depending on the size of that picture, whatever, the pixel that represents this star and the collection of pixels that represents this galaxy, it would make a different sound, different pitches or whatever. So it really could be anything. But this one was very provocative, and I'm going to give you another hint. The sound might have a slight creepy sound to it because the thing that it actually is could be interpreted to some people as creepy. And here it is. A little creepy, huh?
Yeah. A little outer limits.
Yeah, that's some horror movie shit.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It totally fits it. So the thing that it's from fits in with the theme very nicely. So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, guys, or if you heard something cool, I got a lot of really cool noisies this week that people had sent in. Of course, I'm very particular, right? There's lots of things that a noisy has to have in order for me to pick it. But just send in what you have, and I'll dig through, and I'll pick the ones that work best for the show. You could send anything you got to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. We're going to do a name that logical fallacy this week. This comes from Chris, who is a shark specialist and wants to know about a lot of arguments that he hears whenever somebody gets eaten by a shark.
Baby shark, 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 shark.
Oh, God.
Yep. He says, a large part of my PhD was in shark ecology, so my network is deeply entrenched in this at the moment. Yet I'm constantly disappointed by commentary on all sides, even by other scientists. It is, of course, horrible and incredibly sad for the family. A few very common points I see that I believe contain logical fallacies. So keep in mind, these are things people say after a fatal shark attack. Number one, you have a greater chance of being killed by a dog, horse, cow, toaster, whatever, than a shark. I have no idea if this is a logical fallacy or simply a misunderstanding of probability. Then he talks about the fact that, yeah, maybe per capita that's true, but, you know, the chance of getting harmed by a shark if you're swimming with them is a lot greater than your chance of getting harmed by, say, a dog if you're playing with a dog.
Is that true?
Depends on the shark.
Depends on the shark.
Also, what does he mean by swimming with them? Just swimming in the ocean or actively swimming with a shark?
Like in a tank?
Well, I think if you in proximity to a shark.
If you are in a shark habitat,
I see.
Then you have there's a chance that you could be attacked by a shark. Of course, you're not in a shark habitat, it's 0% chance.
Right, but people get bit by dogs all the time.
So, but he's talking about the relative probability.
Okay.
So, but in any case, what's the, let's get to the logic. I don't, you know, he's not, you know, the point is not the statistics. It's the,
right.
When somebody gets attacked by a shark and killed, saying, well, you have a greater chance of being killed by a dog. What kind of response is that? Is there a logical fallacy in there?
I don't understand the question. Are you saying if it's not true, there's a logical fallacy?
Asking if it is a fallacy.
True, no, even if, let's say it's true. Let's say you are more likely to be killed by a dog, just statistically speaking, than a shark.
I don't see why that would be a logical fallacy.
Well,
just
you're
making
saying
a claim.
It, yeah, I know. But the question is, and this is, he's asking, is this a logical fallacy? But the question, you're saying this in response to a fatal shark attack, as if like you shouldn't be afraid of sharks. Let's put it this way. If I think this is what the implication is as I read it. Like, you shouldn't fear sharks because you're more likely to be killed by a dog.
Well, that's like whataboutism.
Yeah, it's or the logical fallacy is the fallacy of relative privation.
Right,
where,
right.
Like, which you're comparing
politics all the time.
Yeah, you're comparing the absolute benefit, harm, risk, importance, whatever of something relative to something else. Mm-hmm. Is that important? Does it matter what it is relative to something else? That's the question. The fallacy of relative privation means you're using a relative comparison to diminish an absolute value. And of course, the relative comparison's arbitrary.
Unless it's not. And that's the thing.
Unless
about
it's not, you're right.
Fallacies. Yes. Yeah. Sometimes that's a really good argument to make. Other times it's a terrible argument to
make. It's an argument if it's a forced choice. If you're like, mm-hmm. should we swim with sharks or play with dogs? I vote for playing with dogs. Then it's a relevant comparison because you actually have a choice. Or if we have limited funds, should we invest our funds on A versus B? Well, then of course, then comparing A to B is relevant. It is important. But
it can also be helpful to get people past cognitive distortions, right? Like if somebody has a severe phobia of something, yet they engage in another activity regularly. That is more dangerous.
Well, yeah, that is true. If you are, you're afraid of getting killed by a coconut falling on top of your head, you could tell them, well, that's a very small risk compared to the risks that you experience every day.
And yeah, every day that you ride your bike without a helmet, you're putting yourself at much more risk. Yeah.
You probably shouldn't waste time and effort and emotion worrying about something when you're not worrying about these much more likely things to have happen.
Right.
Yeah,
and that's kind of the point, though, isn't it, of that statement? You know, about
that's what I think they're trying to do. Right. But maybe sometimes it's disingenuous. It's sort of like, well, don't be afraid to what you hear it a lot with like airplane, right? Like I'm scared to fly. Well, but it's more dangerous to drive your car. And like I think that is it can be beneficial and it can be helpful, but it can also be disingenuous because the person might be like, yeah, but that's not why I'm afraid to fly. When I'm driving, I'm the one behind the wheel. When I'm flying, the pilot's behind the wheel.
Right.
I'm not in control.
So you're never a passenger in a car?
Right.
But
some people aren't. I can't be a passenger in my own car. Is that weird?
A little bit.
Yes.
It makes me so anxious to ride in the passenger seat of my own car.
All right. Non sequitur. Yeah. So let's go.
That's a fallacy.
But I do think that you're right. The informal logical fallacies are context dependent. And we just mentioned a lot of different context here. But I do think it's important to recognize that it can be a logical fallacy if you're using it wrong, right? If you're using it in an inappropriate context. And what I see a lot of people do is they make a comparison that's completely irrelevant as if it diminishes the thing that you're concerned about, which is legitimate. So let me give you a recent example that we encountered a lot. If you say 0.5% of people who get COVID die, and you say something like, well, this disease kills a higher percentage of people, It's like, okay, so what? It's still half a percentage of people who get COVID die, or whatever the, you know, whatever the number is. You know what I'm saying? Or
yeah. Like, mm-hmm. And therefore, yeah.
You're more likely to get the flu. Who cares? If it's irrelevant,
yeah, it's not
to
what
the
we're
question.
Talking about.
Yeah. We're talking about this is a real risk, and we need to mitigate this risk. And that's what Chris, the writer, is talking about. He's saying we're engaged in reducing the risk of getting killed by sharks. How likely it is to get killed by bees is irrelevant,
right?
To our attempts at mitigating shark attacks.
And that's what you see with whataboutism all the time.
It's
when people are like, oh, you know, we're spending so much on education. They go, but what about homelessness? And it's like, okay, but that's not what we're talking about right now.
That's relative privation. Absolutely. Yeah. But it's also, it's like you can arbitrarily choose a comparison to magnify or diminish the thing you're talking about. So it's completely arbitrary. It doesn't mean anything.
But it's also what makes people great debaters is when they can do that to their advantage.
Yeah, it doesn't make something less deadly because there's something more deadly than it.
Right.
Because what about mosquitoes? They're more deadly than everything.
Right. All right, here's number – he has three here. Here's number two. It's the shark's home. You know the risks when you enter the water. Okay, that's, I think, just a non sequitur.
Yes. I also don't – again, it's context dependent, but I don't think it's a logical fallacy to make a claim that is a legitimate and meaningful argument. Like, because we say the same thing, right, when somebody, you know, is on safari and they go, ooh, a lion, and they get out of their car and run towards the lion. It's like, what did you think was going to happen?
That? I know. Someone does that?
Yeah. If you're saying
– it's happened before in the media.
If you're arguing that – if you swim in shark-infested waters, you are putting yourself at risk.
Yes,
that,
exactly.
Of course, is true. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make it less sad that somebody died because they got eaten by a shark.
Right.
And so saying it after a fatal attack is not really meaningful. But also, again, if your point is to engage in risk reduction, and, you know, let's say that people swim at the coral reef or whatever it is, it's like this happens, just saying, well, they knew the risk. That's like if the plane crashes, like, well, they knew the risks when they got into the plane. Sure, but we still should try to keep our planes from crashing.
You know? Yeah, it's sort of like a harm reduction approach to drug and alcohol treatment, right? Like instead of just saying abstinence only, which is what we've done for so long, that doesn't work. You can't just say, well, never ever engage and then you'll never have a problem. And so if we're talking about harm reduction, and it sounds like that's what he's doing with shark attacks, you can't just say, well, then just never do it. Well, yeah, obviously that's the way to reduce harm. We know that's the case with abstinence, right? You can't get an STD if you never have sex. Okay, but people are going to have sex. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how we can do it safely.
Yeah. All right, number three. Humans kill millions of sharks every year, so we're the real murderers. So that, again, he says it's a straw man. I guess so, but it's a non sequitur.
Well, and it's also that relative thing again. It's a whataboutism.
It's like, what about
us killing them?
So also he points out that the species that we kill for food are different than the species that kill us, that would potentially attack a human. So they're not the same sharks. Is that relevant? You know, it depends on context. He said that it's a separate issue. You know, with the appropriateness of hunting sharks and whether or not we should be doing it and managing their populations or whatever is a separate issue too. So you're not mitigating the risk by hunting sharks unless you go out and hunt all the great white sharks, whatever. But that's not what they're even talking about, because we don't kill millions of great white sharks every year. We kill ones that we hunt for food mainly.
And also, who is we? Because in most cultures, that's totally not okay. It's anathema.
Yeah, right.
It's only in a handful of places in the world where sharks are systematically killed for food.
So anyway, I think all of these things, again, in the right context, are just they're irrelevant. They're non sequiturs. They're whataboutism, relative privation, or just not relevant to the question.
But it also implies, though, that the argument at hand is set by the arguer. And I think sometimes that's – you can take this to the extreme. And you can say, well, that's not what I'm talking about, but that's not what I'm talking about. But when you are engaging with somebody in good faith, conversations do have more than one point.
Yeah, that's true. The question is, are they just bringing up something that's related, or are they using it as in some way a counter, or to take it away? Again, that's why it's so context dependent.
Right. Here's something Here's an interesting little fact about this scenario.
Also be true. Like, all of those things can be true, and yet maybe right now we're arguing about X, and then we'll move on to Y.
Right.
It's very similar when, you know, when you're talking to somebody about GMOs, and they're super anti-GMOs, and so they start talking about monocropping, and you're like, I hear you. That is a separate conversation. That is a valid conversation to be had, but that doesn't have any bearing on this argument about GMOs.
Yeah, but usually they're explicitly making that statement. They're saying, I'm against GMOs because they encourage monocropping.
Because
is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
But if the because isn't there, if it's just a this and this, you know, I don't. That doesn't necessarily make it a logical fallacy. It just means you're engaging with somebody.
But I think in each of these cases, he's saying, like, people say, well, it's okay that this person got eaten by a shark because we kill even more sharks than shark kill humans.
I think I missed that context. It's sort of like...
These are always in response to somebody dying from a fatal shark attack. Like, if your response
is like a Schadenfreude
thing. Well, we kill more of them than they kill of us. It's like, okay, that's irrelevant.
Right.
You know, to the fact that we're trying to do risk reduction, you know, or that this
was a tragedy.
And also
that one person, it's not like that shark was retaliating for all the shark murder that person had committed in their
that
life.
Guy
that
probably
might be a different
didn't kill millions of sharks.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Thanks for that, Chris. Okay, guys, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. Jay, I think you're going to like the theme.
Yes.
The theme is bread.
Nice.
Bread.
I thought you were going to say teeth.
No.
I thought you were going to say Thanksgiving.
No.
No.
Bread. No. All right. Here we go. Item number one. In 1943, sliced bread was banned in the United States, even threatening, quote-unquote, stern action against private shops slicing bread. But the order was rescinded within 2 months due to public outrage. All right, number two, physicists recently developed a technique for leavening bread without yeast or chemicals by directly dissolving gas into the dough. And item number three, a recent systematic review of studies concluded that increased average daily bread consumption, regardless of type, is associated with a reduced risk of obesity and overweight. Kara, go first.
Okay. I mean, the one that, like, gets you right off the bat is this, like, well, the band sliced bread in 43. Like, there's no way. That doesn't make any sense. But then I'm starting to think about it a little more, and I'm like, okay, it's 1943. It's like World War II. Maybe, you know, you can buy a loaf of bread, at least in other countries, usually you can buy a loaf of bread just like, you know, you buy a baguette, it's sort of in its own wrapper. But as soon as you slice it up, you got to like seal it, you got to like package it. Maybe that's an issue. I don't know. On its surface, though, that seems ludicrous, but it could be science. I think this, the physicist developing a technique for leavening bread without yeast, this one's interesting to me because I'm wondering what the religious implications are of this. Mm. But maybe it doesn't matter how it's leavened, just that it's leavened. But so instead of having microorganisms eating the sugars and like putting off gases, they're just adding gas to the dough. What? If physicists can't figure that out, we're not in a good place. Somebody's got to know how to just put bubbles in at the right time and make the bread rise, right? Somebody's got to have done that. So that one seems like science. So then the systematic review of studies, and it's recent, concluded that increased average daily bread consumption, regardless of type, is associated with a reduced risk of obesity and over... No, that can't be true. What if somebody's eating white bread, like Wonder Bread every day? Isn't that going to make you gain weight? Yeah, that one has to be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
I don't know, Kara. I would think, I mean, maybe if you eat more bread, it's, you know, you're just more full for longer than if you ate something that would be more calorie dense. I could kind of, you know, wrap my head around that one. And I liked also what you said about number one with the sliced bread, banning that. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but yeah, World War II, there could be something in there that made it, you know, they're trying to save money or you know, use metal that would be used in cutting the bread. I don't know, for the war effort. The one that's obvious to me is, yeah, it's the leavening the bread with dissolved gas directly. Sounds like a really cool idea. And I can't imagine why this wouldn't work. I'm not sure how they would actually do that, but that doesn't sound like a major problem. So for me, it's between banning sliced bread or the bread consumption. Jay, what do you think?
Has that ever worked, Bob?
No, I don't think anyone's been stupid enough to even try that.
I can tell you what I think because I just told you.
Right. All right. So, all right, I'll go with the obesity one. Fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Damn. Ugh. All right. Steve, this is the greatest science or fiction since something. all right, the sliced bread one. I think I had heard about this, and I think Bob was onto something. I think it had to do with, obviously, the war is the factor here, and you couldn't use the machinery for the industrial slicing of bread. It had to be repurposed for other things, and I think that ties into this. Oh, boy. But, you know, this one where Kara and Bob are choosing this one as fiction, the systematic review of studies, this is too obvious. I mean, it's like smacks you in the face. Like, yes, of the three, this is clearly, fiction in a way. But then, therefore, it may not be. I think it's the reverse. Steve, you're playing a prank on us here. But geez, this one about dissolving gas into the dough, directly dissolving gas into the dough. What would be the problem with that? Gee whiz, this is the one I'm technically having the hardest time with. So it's between that one and the systematic review. Do I go against the grain? Cue the laugh track there.
Ah, nice. Sorry.
Yes,
nice.
I will.
Sorry. Missed it. Sorry.
It's all right. You'll hear it on the replay.
It was good.
Oh, gosh. It's so obvious that number three is fiction, which is why it may not be the fiction. All right, I guess I'll die on the same hill as Kara and Bob and say that that one is also fiction, but I will not be surprised if we're all wrong there.
Okay, Jay.
So the first one about the bread was being, you know, that was banned in the United States. I completely think that this one is science. I'm not sure about all the details that you put in here about stern action and all that stuff, but I think that one is science. The second one here about the physicist who developed a technique for leavening bread without yeast. I think that this is cromulent.
Good.
So the yeast produces gas, which makes bread fluffy, right? Because as the dough is springing in the oven, the yeast goes through like this explosion of gas emissions because of the heat. That's why you don't want to overproof your bread, because if you overproof it, the yeast doesn't have any more energy left and they can't produce the gas that you want to give the bread that spring. So, if they do that, if they put the gas, dissolved gas into the dough, it would puff it up. But I got to get to the third one here, because this one, I mean, I'm agreeing with you guys. You know, the important thing here is increased average daily bread consumption. And then he says, regardless of type. So,
yeah.
You know, highly processed white bread that has been stripped of its nutrition is very different than whole wheat bread. Whole wheat bread is quite good for you in a lot of ways. It's still, you're sure. Still getting a massive carb load, and carbohydrates directly are connected to your blood sugar level, which is connected to obesity.
Oh, yeah.
So I think number three is by far and above the fiction here.
Wow.
All right. So you guys all agree on the third one, so we'll take these in order. We'll start with number one.
They're going to start with three. If you start with the third one, we were toast.
1943,
toast. Very
was
good,
banned
Jay.
Banned in the U.S., even threatening certain action against private shops slicing bread, but the order was rescinded within 2 months due to public outrage. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes.
Yay. Yes. Weird, but yay.
Yeah, and you are correct. This is due to World War II, and they were trying to save a lot of stuff, you know, conserve and for the war effort. So what were they trying to save here? It wasn't the bread slicing machines. You know, they already existed. They were where they were.
Energy?
I think I said I thought maybe it was like wrappers, right?
You're correct.
Like,
it was the wrapping. So because sliced bread needs
– it goes bad.
It needs thicker wrapping than unsliced bread. That's it.
Unsliced bread doesn't technically even need wrapping.
It does if you're selling it. Like if you're mass producing. But that, who cares about that? They're talking about like Wonder Bread. For the war effort, they want to know like the big industries that were selling sliced bread. So when did the bread slicing become a thing. Pre-sliced bread.
Oh, I thought
I don't know. Was in the 40s. I thought that happened.
1928. Wow. It was invented in the United States. And by 1933, around 80% of bread sold in the U.S. was pre-sliced. 80%. And
amazing.
The inventor coined the term. It was Otto Frederick Rowetter.
Best Rowetter, thing since sliced bread.
Of Davenport. Mm-hmm. I invented the term greatest thing since sliced bread as a marketing
strategy. Nice.
Which was brilliant. That has changed it power. 100 years.
It was instantly really, really popular. You know, we take it for granted, but
what,
slicing
the expression
bread,
or sliced bread?
Both. Slicing. Slicing bread apparently was a huge source of drudgery. And
yeah, it's a massive time saver. We love things
totally.
To save us time.
So to save the extra thick wrapper that they required, they banned it in 1943 in January, and there was immediate outrage. Like the public absolutely hated it. So famously, the New York Times published a letter from a distraught housewife. And I'm going to read the letter verbatim. She wrote, "I should like to let you know how important sliced bread is to the morale and saneness of a household. My husband and four children are all in a rush during and after breakfast. Without ready sliced bread, I must do the slicing for toast. 2 pieces for each one. That's 10. For their lunches, I must cut by hand at least 20 slices for 2 sandwiches apiece. Afterward, I make my own toast, 22 slices of bread to be cut in a hurry." And so apparently this was like a typical, American household day.
You could just not eat toast every day.
Mid-20th century problems.
Yeah,
apparently that wasn't an option. And so, the thing is, it was like you did this without thinking about how much of a massive impact this was going to have on your typical housewife. And that letter got a lot of purchase, and it kind of brought to the peak the public pushback against this. So like delis and local shops are trying to take up the slice by slicing bread for people at their with the machines that they had, because they had bread slicing machines, but they banned that too because they said that it's an unfair competition with the big industries. I guess they put pressure on them. Because no one's buying our bread because it's not pre-sliced.
Big bread lobby goes.
March of 1943, they rescinded the ban. And they said, you know what? It didn't really save that much wax paper anyway. So
yeah, you know, we're already fighting a world war. Let's not have another
total
war here.
Failure.
It's
total
so funny because we think of this era, right? Like the sort of romanticism of housewives were going to work as riveters, and people took these massive sacrifices for the war effort. Yet don't touch my sliced bread.
Do not.
I'll go to work full time. I don't care. Just don't touch my sliced bread.
The ROI was just not there. All right, let's go to number two. Physicists recently developed a technique for leavening bread without yeast or chemicals by directly dissolving gas into dough. You guys all think this one is science.
Yes.
And this one is science. This is you guys were not nearly as skeptical of that one as I thought you would be. How do you think they did it? It doesn't just happen.
They used little injector needles.
Yeah, and they directly.
No, I would think
that would not work.
The relative pressure in the environment.
Yes,
could have done that too. Yeah,
in a vacuum.
Pressure. Yeah. You can't just inject air into dough because
while it's baking, you can make a robot do that.
It has to be while it's baking.
Yeah.
In fact, the pace at which the air gets released inside the dough has got to be very carefully timed. If it happens too quickly, it actually can break the bread. In essence, it actually, it's
It'll
not good for
apart,
the bread.
Yeah.
You won't get a good texture, a good consistency.
Yeah.
This is a classic engineering problem.
Yeah. So what they did was they used an autoclave basically to heat the dough under high pressure.
and increase the pressure at the same time.
Yes, heat and pressure at the same time. Then they had to figure out at what rate to release the pressure because the pressure gets it's exactly like you make carbonated soda, right? So the pressure gets the gas into the bread. And then as they release the pressure, that gas expands. It makes bubbles, right? But it can't be too quick. It's got to be over a careful amount of time. This is a method for making yeastless bread. They're focusing on pizza dough. And they're going to do – this was an experiment, but they're going to do it next in an autoclave that's designed for actual human food consumption, not in a lab one that they used.
I was going to say, how many labs now are autoclave? are craving
their pizza,
dough,
yeah,
like in between their
right. So it's a cool idea. I had to say also without yeast or chemicals, because you know baking soda does that too. Anything that releases gas in a reaction will do it.
Yeah, but imagine though you could titrate that to such a degree and make like the ultimate bread.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Like really tweak it and experiment, make an tiny little changes here and there. Whoa, be worth it to get epic bread.
Sort of over the, I mean, I know over the counter bread makers use yeast, but you could easily just have like a, you know, like people have those like machines, like those bread making machines where they just put all of the ingredients in. It's all timed perfectly. The pressure's right. The temperature's right.
Yeah. And it comes out okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We had a bread machine.
Have that on your countertop.
Yeah, but that's
the perfect bread.
Yeah, but they use yeast, right?
Use yeast, or, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But this would just be like one engineering challenge away.
So what's the impetus for this? Like, we're having a yeast shortage, or?
Well, some people
we're
can't.
We're born in the lab, okay?
Some people are not tolerant to yeast. They're allergic or whatever, so.
Really? Yeast allergy?
Can you eat yeast if you're vegan?
Yes.
You can.
Also,
right, because
the whole the anti-GMO people kind of ignore the whole yeast thing. Because otherwise, no cheese, right?
Right.
God forbid.
Yeah, vegans don't eat cheese, no but
I'm not talking about vegans. I'm talking about anti-GMO people.
Oh, anti-GMO.
Yeah. And even in fact, in like anti-GMO laws, they like quietly make exceptions for cheese because otherwise it's basically all GMO.
Hypocrites, all of them.
Yeah.
Okay, that means that a recent systematic review of studies concluded that increased average daily bread consumption, regardless of type, is associated with a reduced risk of obesity and overweight. This is the fiction, but this is more complicated. You guys were way too certain about this one too, because this is a fiction, but you can't just flip it and say that it's true. The literature is actually quite mixed. It's quite mixed. And in fact, there are studies which show that eating bread on a regular basis is associated with reduced risk of obesity and overweight. But the most recent systematic review found that it's only that white bread, Jay, you're exactly right. White bread increases obesity and brown, like whole wheat bread or whatever,
the grains,
reduces
the real grains.
It. Yeah, but then they said, but we lack a scientific operational definition of quote unquote whole wheat. And we would need that in order to really make this more specific.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, because how much wheat is whole wheat? You've seen that, like, whole, quote-unquote whole wheat bread that's basically slightly brown Wonder Bread. Like,
right,
you guys
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that's that obvious, really
whole,
though.
It's not whole grain. It's very...
Stone-ground whole wheat.
They are really pushing the definition of what whole wheat is. Yeah. So that's what they're talking about.
Okay.
Mm.
But it's not bad. Eating bread every day is, in fact, not bad. Even white bread. It's not that high in calories. It is very filling.
Moderate.
As long as it's in moderation, it's fine. But you probably should eat whole wheat bread instead of white bread.
I always choose that.
It's easy for
possible.
Me.
I was under the impression that eating like Wonder Bread, like multiple slices a day, was like horrible for you.
Yeah.
No, it's not that. It's not the best choice. It's just not the best choice.
No, but I don't think it's good for you. I don't think it has much nutritional value at all.
Well, that's a problem. Yeah, that's probably.
Well, neither does an apple.
Or those peanut butter cups.
Apples do. They have micronutrients.
Yeah, you would look at the nutrient. You know, the nutrients of an apple, there's not a hell of a lot there. You know,
vitamin C,
micronutrients,
mostly in the skin.
Grab a different fruit. If you're really going to obsess about eating a healthy fruit, I wouldn't be eating apples every day, all day.
What about pineapple?
On the spectrum, I think it's low in terms of nutrient density. That's all I'm saying there.
Okay.
Bananas are awesome, and strawberries are awesome. I love white bread. I love them too. Berries,
I think, are your best bet. Right?
Fine, but like, white bread, it's not only low in nutritional benefit, it's also high in empty calories. That's the thing. It's like, it's full
filler.
Of sugar.
Yeah, and sugar.
And complex carbohydrate, or simple
carbohydrates. Simple carbohydrates.
Sugars. Which is why kids love it.
Sugars and starches.
Yeah, but if you're like, if you're an active, fit person, I think your body would just totally shrug that off.
That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about obesity risk here. Like, yes, you're right. If somebody is eating white bread before they run a marathon, have as much as you want.
No, not even a marathon. Not a marathon, but if you're reasonably fit, it's not like poison. You're making it sound like...
Yeah, Karen, it's not as bad as you're making it out to be. It really isn't. Think about this. In the UK, they eat a lot more bread than we do, actually. They eat, because they eat a lot of sandwiches. They're generally, you know, less overweight than Americans are, and they eat more bread.
Yeah, but I don't know if we can say that that's why. They might also walk
I'm not saying
more
that's why. I'm just saying right. you like but you're making it sound like if you eat bread every day like you've got to be obese. It's just not
no,
true.
No, 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 no. I'm just saying like there's nothing good for you about eating white bread. It doesn't it's not a good food.
It tastes good.
Could they should do they enhance it at all with vitamins or anything?
You could.
Some of it is fortified with things like I think folic acid. Yeah. But
calcium, I think that calcium bread. But in any case, for me, it's easy because I love whole grain, whole wheat bread anyway.
I do too. I love
what do you guys
taste better?
Whole how do you guys feel better. About whole wheat pasta?
About what?
I've had it, and I don't mind it. It definitely
like
is different.
I've never
it's
had
different.
Much experience with it, Steve. It's just like,
it depends
like
what
it,
you have
I like it
with.
Better.
Yeah,
it can taste. It better? Totally depends. Damn. You're right, Evan. You're
what,
totally right. It
what you have
on
it with
the sauce?
Yeah,
what are
the
you
sauce
cooking?
Or chicken? What kind of protein you're having it with? It.
I like it with anything. It's hearty. It's hearty. I like brown rice better than white rice.
Me hearty.
Some pastas should be lighter.
It's the vegetable pasta I find
now,
a little bit difficult. And the omega-3
pasta. Recently, don't get me started. One time I had fish pasta.
Yeah, the fish
pasta. Like, why does the house smell like fish?
Stank up the whole kitchen. Horrible. Yeah. But I recently tried two alternative pastas. So, yeah, of course, pasta is wonderful, but I love whole wheat pasta. It would be my preference. But I tried corn pasta.
What? Ooh, I would eat that. I would eat that.
OMFG. Tell me about it now.
Corn pasta's good.
It's like cornbread.
It was weird. It was weird. It wasn't bad.
Not good.
It was not bad. It was just weird. It was just like, why am I eating corn chips? You know what I mean? Like, just like the flavor was a disconnect with pasta. And it didn't go well with sauce. So and there's no advantage unless you have a wheat allergy, I guess. If you have gluten intolerance, you can have corn pasta and get used to it. But there's no calorie benefit from
right.
going from wheat to
corn. Right, it still has a high glycemic index.
And we probably shouldn't be using our corn for that either, necessarily.
Oh my God, well, we have so much excess corn. We use
I tried chickpea pasta.
Whoa,
what the hell?
Which is
that's
much lower calorie than wheat pasta.
Yeah, but doesn't it fall apart really easily? You have to
but I didn't like it.
It. Yeah, it's just
It didn't have that hummus sort of
it was
taste.
Not really, but it was just like, it was okay, but I was not enjoying eating it, which is a huge disconnect from my usual pasta experience.
Yes.
So it was fine, you know, but I wouldn't, I had it once.
You tried it. Yeah.
Some of the alternative pastas that aren't made of grains, but that are more made of like, legumes or different things like that. It's really hard to eat them al dente.
Mm, yeah.
They just boil into mush if you're not careful. They're just too soft and fall apart.
That
and
sucks.
Pasta should have a little bit of a bite to it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. One day we'll have cricket pasta.
I would try that.
I
bet you someone out there has made it. Yeah. With cricket flour? Sure.
I just typed in cricket pasta. Let me see.
Oh, yeah.
Cricket pasta exists.
It does exist, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Jay, here's your slice with butterflies.
I can order some cricket pasta right now and we could try it.
I'm not going
to
eat it.
I'm up for that. We'll do that on the next live show we do.
Taste it. It's ground up.
It's called Bug Salutely.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. Bug Salutely.
Bug Salutely.
I don't care what they call it. I'm not eating bugs.
Can't taste
Jay,
it when it's
practice
flour.
For the apocalypse, dude.
Yeah, man. We're all heading there.
I'll just keep making my homemade bread and I'll eat that.
That's right.
Out of what? I'll join you. You won't have the core ingredients.
He'll inject it with a gas.
During the apocalypse, he'll just pull out his apocalypse autoclave.
The glaze.
You know, the timing is perfect here. I finally figure out exactly how to bake an amazing home of rustic Italian bread, homemade rustic Italian bread, and now like there's going to be like no more flour. I'm going to have to eat bugs for the rest of my life.
You could probably make just as beautiful a rustic Italian bread with cricket flour.
It'll be cricket legs sticking out of it and poking me in the face.
It'll be like, ground up.
Oh, it's only
20% cricket flour. It's 80% wheat flour. But
there you go. You can.
Yeah, Jay, you can
like
handle that, right? You can't taste it.
There's more rodent excrement in your food.
We got to do
crickets,
a taste test.
You know,
this is crying out for a taste test. Come on.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
For scientists, transparency is a way to promote reproducibility, progress, and trust in research. For philosophers of science, transparency can help address the value-ladenness of scientific research in a responsible way. Nevertheless, the concept of transparency is a complex one. That is from Cambridge University Press from their paper, A Taxonomy of Transparency in Science, which is good reading.
So who wrote it?
Awesome.
Yeah, you know, they didn't. I couldn't get. I couldn't get past the abstract, unfortunately, which is where I pulled it from, and wherever the author or authors are cited, they were not in that section, so gotcha. I could not pull it. But it is. But the it does say from the Cambridge University Press.
And you didn't want to pay money for the full damn thing, did you?
Well, you know, I mean, it's still a good quote.
Yes.
Yeah, transparency is important. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Super important.
Yeah. To the process.
Bugsolutely.
Nah.
All right. Stick, I think. All right. We gave that guy enough free advertising.
And this week's sponsor is?
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
You guys,
Steve.
And until next week. This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.